This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
They're doing things to people. Turning them into some kind of monsters.
Chick is hardcore.
Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today we are looking at the mid-noughties yuckfest Slither, James Gunn's first cinematic outing. And we have a very special guest who Adam will introduce shortly. I will go over some news, introduce said guest, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that this movie brings up, including the complexity of parasite life histories and how a hive mind works. As always, the show will be broken up into a few different segments. There are time codes below, so you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. If you just came to hear our guest today, just skip ahead. We won't be offended.
A little offended.
Yeah, a little offended, but there's nothing we can do to you, so, you know.
I'm still hurt about it, though.
Yeah. Before we get into that, my name is Sam Perrin. I am an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside Adam Harsik, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, having made her way back from the desert, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup.
Mr. Potter.
Dave is also here, a vet and our movie physiologist. News this week, we have feathers on dinosaurs in the Jurassic Park world, finally.
Fucking finally.
So there was the first 5 minutes of Jurassic World Dominion that was put out this week. I was going to say leaked, but it wasn't. It was released by Universal?
Universal.
Put the first 5 minutes out this week. And yeah, we got to see what we're led to believe is the original T-Rex that the clone we've seen in the movies is, you know, made up of. We get to see it killed by a Gigantosaurus that is not another T-Rex, as some journalists have hypothesized. It is a completely different dinosaur. It's supposed to be a Gigantosaurus.
Idiots.
Yeah. I mean, they went to a... It looks very different from the T-Rex, I feel. So, it was a bit weird that they still messed it up, despite Universal having gone to great pains to make it look very different.
But I mean, to be fair about that point, though, if you pointed out two different birds, I'm like, look at these. I'm like, well, those are birds. Well, that's obviously a rock pigeon. This one's obviously a different kind of pigeon. Well, okay.
Fair enough, yeah.
I can only think of one pigeon, if that tells you anything.
Yeah. Columbia pigeon. No, I think it's...
A stool pigeon.
I think...
Stay.
There you go.
Yeah, wise guy.
But yeah, and they show a T-Rex that has feather-like appendages, a feather-like covering. I don't know if they're true feathers, but they look really cool.
A downy coat.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they show some Asdarchids. Asdarchids are a type of pterosaur, so not technically a dinosaur, a flying reptile, and they seem to have a feathery coat as well, which is, yeah, I think is really cool. So
nice. We actually had a bit of dinosaur news in Missouri. There were four new species discovered.
Really?
Really?
Mm-hmm. What sort of dinosaurs?
I have to look it up. One of them is, it's like Missourians. Yeah. They worked in Missouri in there.
Missouri dinosaurs. Here we go. Show me a saurus? Oh, what?
God damn it. I hate that. So, in the U.S., our states have slogans, and for whatever reason, the slogan of Missouri is the Show Me State. I don't know what that even means.
I think it's like, show me a good part about the state. I dare you.
Okay. No, but it's not called that. They've found a newly identified duck-billed dinosaur, so I'm assuming they're talking about a hadrosaur, called Parasaurus missouriensis. So yeah, missouriensis literally just means coming from Missouri. Fucking lazy bastards.
Mm-hmm. They could have named it the Bradpittosaurus, also from Missouri.
Yeah. But yeah, regarding Jurassic Park, I think it's really cool that they have lent into this idea of... Yeah, the dinosaurs had feathers, but the ones we've created, since we're filled in, you know, with DNA from other things and we've kind of decided what we wanted to look like, they don't have to have feathers, okay? They're genetic creations. Feathers look stupid. I don't believe that. I think they look great, but I think this is what they're saying. And so, yeah, you're not getting feathers.
Their genetic code is amphibian anyway.
Yeah. Enjoy your 5 seconds of feathers, you fucking nerds.
You bred raptors.
This week we are doing the movie Slither, which is about an alien traveling via the galaxy subway, aka meteors, that crash lands in a small town and immediately infects a man with either two first or last names. That's kind of still unclear. Said alien classically falls in love with the infected man's wife. Then, as if it were plucked straight from the pages of an Austenian romance, he finds a side piece to become its barn-kept breeder with the purpose of infecting everyone in the town with its slug babies to create a literal single-minded army. Handsome Nathan Fillion-esque cop, who also has a crush on this guy's wife, decides to save her and the town with the help of a teenage girl who bit off more than she could chew.
Thank
you.
They kind of fail, but the soon-to-be grieving widow seals the deal and explodes her infected husband. Basically, extraterrestrial parasite homewrecker breaks up a marriage that even dashing uniform-wearing Nathan Fillion could not.
Hmm.
And if he can't, who fucking can?
Exactly.
So dashing. So dashing.
That hair. So beautiful.
So do we have any trivia for this week?
Yeah. So some of the trivia, the name of the high school in the movie is Earl Bassett High, after a character in Tremors, as of many of the characters, places, and buildings, because they all, there's like a ton of Easter egg references to 20th century monster movies. So like pretty much any prominent monster movie from the 20th century, there's a reference in there. It's either a character name, building name, town name. Yeah.
Nice.
I feel like that's the first kind of indication of James Gunn putting his like upbringing, his likes into his movies, because everyone knows it's like Guardians of the Galaxy and now the Suicide Squad having all these fun musical scores. It's like, no, that's just the music he grew up listening to that he really likes. So now in this movie that he made, he's like, I like all these movies. Fuck it. Let's put them in here.
Exactly.
Did anybody else spend this entire movie waiting for Sean Gunn to show up somewhere?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You totally missed him then. He plays the deer.
I knew it.
One of the tentacles. So another bit is horror director, musician Rob Zombie actually has a cameo as the voice of Dr. Carl, who Starla talks to on the phone. And then the last bit of trivia I have is Michael Rooker actually wound up dislocating his shoulder during the scene where he grows his long floppy arm, but he didn't say anything for the entire day until they were done shooting.
Ow. So, short bit of trivia on my own, just from the scientific perspective. I don't get to do enough math for this podcast like I used to when we started this
No one ever.
I would calculate out how big Kong was, how many breaths he took, the size of his muscle strands, the density of his bone. I don't do any of that anymore. However, I got to do some fun calculations for this one. So rewatching this, Brenda, the breeder, the one who gets infected at the initial part and then swells up to carry all of those worms basically within her. It is a gross scene. So she's seen to be eating constantly throughout this movie, and Grant has to go out to get hunks and hunks of meat to try and feed her, to try and increase her mass. So out of curiosity, I sat down and I was like, how much does a pregnant woman have to consume on a regular basis? So the average woman needs to consume, according to the World Health Organization, between 200 to 300 extra kilocalories per day on top of her normal diet in order to make a baby. With the average pregnancy lasting around 280 days, this means kind of over the course of time to generate your average sized 3.5 kilogram baby, a woman will need to take in an extra basically 70,000 kilocalories of energy. Now, what does that look like? Because that's just sort of a number. So 70,000 kilocalories of energy represents approximately 246 chicken breasts or 42.3 kilograms of chicken to make one 3.5 kilogram baby. Another way of thinking about that is it's approximately 466 servings of steak or approximately 39.6 kilograms of beef. So that's basically a 12-to-1 ratio of either beef of chicken in to try and generate baby mass out. So if we take Brenda at her biggest, and I needed some sort of measurement of weight, so like I always do, When I'm thinking about concerns with obesity, I turn to the United States, the world's heaviest woman. At her largest weight had reached 1,603 pounds or 727 kilograms. Her name was Carol Ann Yeager. So let's say that when Brenda's at her biggest, the extra mass that she's taken on is approximately an extra Carol Ann Yeager, which I actually think is quite an underestimate. I think that the amount of she shakes in that shed and the entire shed shakes. But if she takes that in, she will need to consume approximately, let's say 8,000 kilograms of beef. So just so you know, the average cow is approximately 720 kilograms, which means she would need to consume at least 11 cows to try and gain the mass of the world's heaviest woman from a gestation perspective.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Just for another fun little tidbit on top of that, that is the equivalent of 312 tons of CO2 equivalents emitted for that diet. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I appreciate in this movie, he is constantly getting meat. He's at the grocery store. He's hunting down people's family pets. He's the raccoons in the woods. And he's just pulling cows right off the farm, dragging them back to feed.
That's a lot of meat. That's... Yeah.
It's also an interesting point that I'd made to Sam to talk about his partner and be like, do you realize in order to generate the kid, you needed to consume an extra 42.3 kilograms of tissue?
You can tell which of us has never ever talked to a pregnant woman about her weight before. Dave suggesting that I should ever bring that up. Yeah. Just a fun fact for everyone out there. If Michael Rooker had switched to an entirely chicken diet for his baby mama, he would have saved 250 tons of CO2.
Wow.
So, you know.
Mm-hmm. What would happen if he switched to a tofu diet?
Depends where you're getting the soy from, but it would probably be the equivalent of another 10 tons on top of that he would probably save.
And Sam, do you feel this movie would have been as terrifying if it was a basement filled with packages
just of filled tofu? No, I don't.
Nate. Howdy, Mr. Grant.
Oh, hey there, killer.
What can I do you for?
Give me a couple of your ribeyes.
How many you need?
8. Not 10. No. You know what? Give me 14.
Adam, would you like to introduce today's guest?
It would be my pleasure. Joining us this week on the pod is the number one New York Times bestselling author, Scott Sigler, creator of 18 novels, 6 novellas, and dozens of short stories. Scott actually started his career by narrating his unabridged audiobooks and releasing them in weekly installments on his podcast, Scott Sigler Audiobooks, which has been running since March of 2005 and is the world's longest running fiction podcast. Oh. Scott's stories were actually how I first heard about him, and he's been publishing his works since shortly after he started releasing them. His rabid fans are called the Junkies, and I count myself as one of them. Looking forward to the weekly releases to get our little fix of Scott's fiction. Scott is the co-founder of Empty Set Entertainment and publishes his Galactic Football League series, and a Michigan native, I cannot speak today. Scott now lives in San Diego, California with his wife and the wee little dogs of doom. And it's very important. Those are Norwegian O's with a slash through them.
Doom.
Doom.
Thank you guys for having me on. I'm excited about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for coming. So we're talking about Slither today, and we thought we should all start by just going over what we liked about this film. I love the cast. I think Michael Rooker is amazing. He kind of steals the show from Nathan Fillion and Elizabeth Banks, which is a very hard thing to do. But just his...
That's a big ask.
Yeah, his behavior, his facial expressions and tics, it's just so unsettling, but not in a way that is just full-on gross out, which the rest of the special effects in the movie are. So I think, the cast of this movie is incredible.
I love the setting. I grew up not in a very small town in the South, but in a small enough town that seeing movies like this in this kind of setting really, like, always get a solid thumbs up from me. And then having a solid creature feature on top of that is just icing on the cake.
Nice. Scott, do you want to tell us what you liked about this one?
I also really like Michael Rooker's performance. When he goes with the full prosthetics and all of the gross out makeup, particularly at the end, he is still able, with all of that crap on his face, to emote a deep love for the Elizabeth Banks character. And he does that through the whole movie, but particularly in the final stanza when he is facing off with her. And it's just an incredible bit of acting in the midst of this schlocky, super fun creature feature. So that was impressive. And Nathan Fillion is just also spectacular in this. The deadpan delivery, his timing is great. And Elizabeth Banks is also, I like that as serious as an actress as Elizabeth Banks can be, she brought all the gravitas and seriousness to this just monster flick. And it was really fun. So those are my favorite things. The life cycle is fun too. I've been reading up on it a little bit. I'm sure we're going to discuss that. But one of my favorite things with movies is you can see James Gunn wrote this and kind of like, I just need these pieces to be here, and watching scientists come in after the fact and try and apply science to something that doesn't have a lot of scientific basis is one of my favorite things in the world.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed all the Easter eggs, kind of tying into the trivia that I did earlier. It was just really fun to see like a name that I recognize, be like, oh, that's from Tremors, or oh, that's from The Thing. Because there were so many, it was just like an ongoing sort of like a Where's Waldo of 20th century monster flicks. So that was a lot of fun to me.
Yeah. I really loved the mayor, Jack McCready, played by Greg Henry. Just his line.
Oh, McCready.
Yeah.
There you go. There's another Easter egg. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There's
yeah.
another one.
And exactly. His delivery is absolutely fantastic. And I love that he cuts through a lot of more of the typical like supportive horror lines of like, don't worry, Brenda, we're going to get you to a hospital. What the fuck is a hospital going to do for her? So, no, I...
You ever see that shit on Animal Planet? I never seen that shit.
And I watch Animal Planet all the fucking time.
And all of these performances, you know, it was really a giant neon sign pointing to what James Gunn was capable of.
Yeah.
I don't know how they got this cast for his first creature feature, but... you know, like everybody's performance in this is really, really good. And even though these are all highly talented actors, that all comes back to the director to be able to thread all that together. Mm-hmm. So there's just so much in here that was indicative of where his career might go.
Yeah. Absolutely.
In terms of what we didn't like, this movie crossed a line for me in terms of the gross out humor and effects. At certain times, I was just like, I really felt nauseous a couple of times watching this, which doesn't often happen for me. I'm generally got a pretty strong stomach for gore. I just don't like horror movies that much, but there's just a couple of moments where everything's like melting into the one big creature and just, Yeah. So
should,
I think
you should avoid my books, by the way. It's not going to work out for you. Yeah.
But yeah, I will say that up until like, until it got to that point where it was too gross for me, it was a massive positive of the film. But then it went over and I was like, oh, no, this is no longer a positive. This is bad.
Well, that's when it gets into the super fun collective. We're going to talk about the collective organism part of it was just crazy. So
I think I'm the same as Sam, where it's obviously something about the movie that I appreciate and it really brings a lot to it. But some things I just don't want to see and I don't want to hear in concert with seeing it at the same time. And it's like, I bet that... At least I wasn't smelling it, you know? So it's obviously a good thing, but ugh.
Probably be really moist in the air, like humid and
fetid.
Yeah.
Sweaty.
Fetid. Good word. Good word.
Libby?
I think for me, I want to harp on something story based. I did not like the teen girl character. I think we talked about this before. I feel like she was entirely just a plot device, right? Like you have this character just to be like, oh, I had a vision with the alien and this is, you know, what's going to happen and why they're here. And it's like, wait, who are you again? So I just, I felt like they could have done that so easily with Nathan Fillion's character.
Yeah.
And he could have had those same visions and things like that.
That felt like there was something on the cutting room floor with that, that there was some connection between the girl and Nathan that would have helped a lot.
Exactly.
Yeah. Scott, what about yourself?
I'm kind of meticulous with my monster work and try to give a rational or plausible explanation for all elements of a creature's life cycle and my stuff. So the thing that I wish I could have seen is how does this giant Eric Cartman blob get launched launch something off planet and target it and discover another living world and send it out there. Now, I mean, it could be this just like in my book, Infected, they're just firing colony blips all over the place, hoping they get lucky with something. But I would really like to have seen, once you see the final form of the creature, how the F does that build a rocket? How does that build something that will escape gravity and get somewhere else? So that was the thing that I was left wanting with the most.
Yeah.
Dave?
I don't have anything other than this small town reminds me way too much of home. And I have moments watching it. I'm like, oh, crap. That looks like the bar that was next door. But no, I absolutely love this film. I love all the scenes. And I mean, the grenade into the pool still gets me every time, where there's like the whole buildup. Yeah. They've been referencing it the entire time, and then mm-hmm. bounces into the pool and it goes off and yep. you like collectively.
Great red herring.
Yeah. Collectively, I feel like everyone watching it is like, well, fuck.
Yeah, because they planted that so early on. They're like, hey, we've got this grenade. Should we take it? No. Just like, oh, that's a weird Chekhov's grenade kind of thing.
A little bit. I think the important thing to bring up, though, about this reminding Dave of home is, in Canada, they don't have deer season, they have moose season. And instead of hunting the moose, it's when the moose start hunting the people. So you have to stay.
Oh, my gosh.
It keeps the population under control, so.
Actually, Adam, I think you'll find that moose are just a type of deer, so moose season is still deer season.
Yeah.
Actually, no.
Actually, yeah.
At up to 1,700 pounds and 7 feet tall, at the shoulders, the moose is always going to be one of those animals God forgot to put a size cap on. Moose are part of the Capriolinae deer family. Only problem is this roy deer is closer in size to an elephant than to a full-grown Bambi.
So, before we start looking at the science in today's film, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. Just type in cinematicaanimalia and you'll find us. If you'd like to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear more of Scott's work, you can find him on Twitter at Scott Sigler. You can check out his podcast, Scott Sigler's Audiobooks, or check out his most recent book, The Stone Wolves, which is a standalone novella set within the larger Galactic Football League series of novels and novellas. And if you want something a little more closely related to today's episode, you should check out Infected, the first book in Scott's Infected trilogy. And as always, if you want to hear more about some of the more hardcore, less movie-related science that Adam and I write about, check out ecologyforthemasses.com.
So this is, like Scott mentioned just a second ago, this is a complex parasitic organism with multiple stages in its life. And normally what you see in this, in nature, at least on our planet, there's who knows what kind of parasites there are in the water universe. Maybe Slither's real. We'll never know. But an organism that goes through all these different stages has to adapt to each one of the hosts in concert. So you have a organism that starts out maybe in a snail. The snail becomes infected, much like Brenda in the barn, and just starts shedding all of these infective stages that go swimming through the water. These swimming stages will then infect maybe a larval dragonfly, a larval damselfly, a frog, whatever. And it then changes something about their life that then makes them easier to consume by another, maybe there's many different ways this can happen, but this example I'm giving, it makes them easier to consume by the final predator, which is usually a bird of some kind. So snail to amphibian to bird. All of those are completely different organisms and involve very specific adaptations along the line. This thing is just doing whatever the hell it wants with whatever the hell it wants, whenever the hell it wants. I think Scott's point about it getting to the planet is a very key one, and it's something that I would like to see as well, but I'm going to do a lot of hand-wavy science of maybe there's some kind of biological mechanism where it can produce rocket fuel, like one of similar to one of the creatures in Scott's GFL series, which is
really powerful trebuchet.
Yeah, something super powerful, but it gets to Earth, it changes people's behavior, specifically Michael Rooker, to begin impregnating people and then produce more of these infective stages that then go on and transform people to form this hive mind, giant creature, craziness ensues. I think the only thing that could kind of produce this kind of behavior, this type of organism, is a crazy variable environment. Because you need some kind of intense selection to be able to adapt to any kind of behavior, any kind of situation that you find yourself in. So the thought behind that is, and this is something I'm getting into recently, it's going to be the focus of my postdoc actually here in Israel, is that if you live in a very variable environment, you might not have the chance to adapt to any one thing in particular, but you become really good at adapting to anything. So kind of jack of all trades, master of none type approach. So that's what I think is happening with this creature. But the only issue that I have is just how much it modifies the host behavior, specifically Michael Rooker's character. Grant, best name forever for a character. I think that it making him a completely different person is something that just is not going to work. Because with these type of parasites that manipulate host behavior, what it usually is a very subtle hijacking of a very specific behavior in the host. So my favorite example of that is the liver lance fluke. Basically, it's a parasite that infects an ant. And the ant will go about its normal ant day, living, doing its ant activities. But then at night, it will climb up onto a blade of grass, bite on the grass, and do a little headstand. And it will just wait all night. And then when the night's over, it goes back down and goes about its day. But if a horse happens to come along and is eating around dinner time, and it happens to chomp up that ant while it's eating grass, the parasite that's inside of the ant could then complete its life cycle in the horse. The horse will defecate it out. Snails come along and go through the feces. They pick up the infected stages and the cycle starts all over again, where an ant will then become infected from a snail. But it's one subtle thing that changes. Subtle. I mean, it's doing a headstand all night. That's pretty intense. I can't do that. But it just changes one aspect. So what I'm thinking would actually have to happen for this is that you have this parasite make Michael Rooker maybe a bit more of a lech than he already is. He's now going out trying to sleep with all the younger women in town and trying to impregnate them, but otherwise he's still Grant being a sleaze.
But stuff can still, like, this horrifying stuff can still happen to those younger women though, right?
Right. So I think that would be the next stage where they all become Brendas. I think as Libby put it, what was it? A barn dwelling behemoths. There was a wonderful bit of assassination going on there.
That's the breeder part of the life cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
So Adam, you're suggesting like just one shift in behavior. Like he just eats too much or he has sex too much. In this case, that has sex too much. And then the rest of the life cycle takes on.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that change in behavior is what facilitates the transmission to the next stage.
Okay. Scott, do you think that this trait that Adam's come up with, just a huge increase in promiscuity, could have still led to an engaging film?
Oh, sure. We got sexually transmitted diseases, you know, like that. There's the basic urge to reproduce is a fantastic vehicle for parasitical organisms and bacteria and viruses, just about anything you think of. So that could have absolutely driven it. But with this, clearly it's so much more complicated. And the thing that gets me with it is its ability to know where to go in the body, know where to go to the brain, be able to interpret nervous signals and hijack nervous signals and modify behavior. Now, when something is here on Earth and it evolves with us over millions of years, okay, that survival of the fittest, that makes sense that eventually it figures out a survival strategy that it can modify host behavior. But this coming from another world is one of the more fascinating things for me, because how does it know where to go? How does it integrate with the brain? Is a brain a common thing all over the galaxy? If this thing's a billion years old, it's clearly figured out a lot of strategies. But that's, so if it's got the ability to do that, to figure out where to go and how to communicate and how to take over the brain, it would seem to have a toolbox of behavioral modifications and physical modifications to draw from that has allowed it to succeed and take over all these planets.
Let me ask you a question and be honest.
Do I make you horny?
Randy?
Do I make you horny, baby? Yeah, do I?
God, I hope this is part of the unfreezing process.
So I decided of all the different topics, I thought the hive mind was definitely the most interesting. So, I mean, as we've talked about on this podcast before, there is no such thing as a true hive mind that takes place between groups of species where they are telepathically connected. In the film, the lone one basically generates and connects to everything. Kylie Strohmeyer, the woman that Libby felt was an unnecessary character, during her bite event, later recounts that what they see, he sees. In the climax of the film, the destruction of the lone one or the Grant lone one organism leads to the collapse of the hive mind and termination of all those who are infected. Now, hive ideas are oftentimes talked about. So bees coordinating their action via pheromones, signaling movements, so dances.
I would have loved to see these things just boogieing down to communicate with each other.
Right. So, I mean, we could say that Grant is releasing pheromones, but what I wanted to get into was some truly terrifying research that's currently taking place at a couple of different laboratories, primarily the one taking place at the neuroscience laboratory at Duke University, being taken place with Dr. Miguel Nicolas. So he's an MD, PhD, and he's currently the head of medicine professor in their neuroscience department. So he's got two absolutely terrifying experiments that he's been doing recently. So the first of which I'm simply going to refer to as the monkey hive mind. So in this experiment, two or three different rhesus monkeys were wired into the same robotic arm and then basically asked to perform different tasks. They were taught kind of how to use it and they were run through a different program. Initially, they started with a joystick, but then over a period of time, they were able to realize that if they just thought about where they wanted the arm to move, they could move the arm on the screen to get to sort of different tasks.
Sorry, is this some kind of implant in their brain or is it tracking eye activity? Implant in the brain, okay.
So it's an implant directly into the brain, into these three different monkeys. And again, it did take some time to coordinate and line up and test to get them to a point that they could stare at the screen and think about moving the arm and watch the arm move. Now, the rewards that they ended up getting were usually juice. And in these tasks, they sort of compared two different groups. So they took a lone monkey that was all by themselves and basically said, you've got to move this arm in different ways or put together different pieces to get a reward at the end. And then they took two to three different monkeys, hooked them up, and gave them each a different control aspect. So you control the x-axis, you control the y-axis, you control the z-axis. And terrifyingly, they found that the monkeys that were working together, the pairs of three, would actually fall into sync working together, and in many cases were actually more effective than the lone monkey for controlling the arm and getting the juice at the end of it. So evidence of like a true brain net actually operating and suggesting that the Pacific Rim idea of them sharing the load where they have to control the giant robot could actually be a real thing, as ridiculously as we picked on that. Now, the
also called the Samwise Gamgee strategy.
Right. Now, the much more terrifying experiment involved in the same laboratory, they took four different rats, they hooked their brains directly up to each other. So they did a brain-to-brain network that basically...
So a literal rat king.
Yeah. Yeah. They
did they tie their tails together at the same time?
No, they didn't to. So, and I'm not going to get...
Thought I bloody found him in New York, am I right? Wouldn't have had to do it. Oh, I got him. Got all the New Yorkers and the rats.
I'm not going to get into all of the details as to how they hooked them up, because one, it's a little bit over my head, and two, some of the stuff is a little bit ethically questionable. So one of the ways that they got the brain networks to hook up is they pushed the rats to generate similar neurological patterns so that they would start syncing. And if they didn't, they deprived them of water until they actually synced up. So
really?
Yeah, not great. But they did manage to get all these rats to sync up, and then they basically gave these rats different pieces of information to try and see if they could do problem solving, like a computer. So giving them sets of pixels to generate images, trying to retrieve stored memory information from one rat and seeing if the other rat could get it. And then the weirdest and creepiest one, exposing the different rats to different stimuli that relate to thunderstorms, and seeing if they could put the information together similar to how certain animals can predict an oncoming storm. And they ended up finding that the brain net rats consistently performed at the same or higher level than a single rat in every single task that they were exposed to, suggesting that a brain net could potentially exceed the performance of individual brains due to a distributed and parallel computing architecture. In other words...
So the Matrix.
They made a computer. And this is the lab's goal, is they want to make a biological computer by hooking up different organisms. And actually, they have found that when they operate as a hive organism, there seems to be some suggestion that it can be more effective. Now, currently, this takes place with all of these rats wired in together. Theoretically, if you connected them to Wi-Fi, I imagine you could potentially separate them a little bit. But we don't have... Yeah. Anything like that in the biological world. So the question that I had...
Just give them those 5G injections, right?
The question that I had for Scott for this is, In order to generate a hive mind, theoretically this could work, but these organisms would all need to be connected. Would this movie be equally terrifying, as terrifying, or drastically change if all of the organisms still had to be hooked up to one another? Like long umbilical cords kind of separating between each other.
I think there's definitely some visual play with everything being connected, and you could do a lot of different things. Like here's microfiber connections and all these different things that would look really cool. But the far more terrifying aspect of it is Wi-Fi. And based on what little I've heard, that doesn't seem like that far of a leap at all. If it's an electrical connection that's wired, eventually you can make that wireless.
Yeah.
But just tons of story ideas off of that, because if you can imagine, 5,000 rats operating in unison, and great scenes where they're chasing you and you do something and then they all dead stop, and there's just wonderful moments in there where you're gonna, the rats keep up leveling their ability of what they can do beyond what you think they can do. And you do that stair step thing that you do in storytelling where it's competing escalation. That's really scary. And then something that I eventually want to get into, and other authors have gotten into before, is the trans-species hive mind, where you start to connect, you start to connect, here are rats, oh, here are dogs, oh, here are giraffes, and those start to work together. There was a book like that, and I can't remember the author name, it was a German science fiction author, where basically all the animals of the world were like, we're done with you humans, go fuck yourself, and just all started to coordinate attacks on people. But that's scary. From a storytelling perspective, that's maybe too powerful. There's no way you're going to win that war. It's already over before it begins. But the concept of the wireless communication, the zombie hive mind, the insect hive mind, the slither hive mind, that's what's super scary to me.
That's a very terrifying thought. And also, I just realized, we should mention that one of the reasons we brought Scott on for this podcast, for this episode in particular, is because of his Infected series of books, which were the first series I read by him. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend all of his books. Mm-hmm. But in this series, much like in Slither, you have this extraterrestrial threat infecting people. There's an aspect of hive minds in there. There's a lot of body horror. And there's a bunch of really fun creature feature action tied into the science fiction, with actually a bit more science than Slither goes into. So.
There's a lot of similarity between the two. And I have another book I'll mention in a second that's got some similarities to Slither. But the concept of the plasticity of the biological material and being able to reshape and make, now I'm going to make this tentacle. So it has to have this muscular structure. It has to have these nervous connections. So we're repurposing cellular reproduction of the existing host. So it's not just affecting their behavior through chemical hormone modification. This is a big chunk of Play-Doh, and we can reshape it any way we want to. And in Infected, I give very specific mechanisms about how that could work, which passes my acid test. If a hardcore scientist goes like, yeah, I sort of see that happening, like it's just enough so it's plausible. That's where people who read my work allow themselves to go way down the rabbit hole and embrace the whole thing. Yeah. So that part is a lot of commonality there. Also hive mind concepts going on, but the other one is Nocturnal. Yeah. I don't know if you guys have read that one, but Nocturnal is the concept of taking a subspecies of humanity and making them eusocial. So you've got one breeding queen, and I've had a lot of people compare, what was her name? Brenda to the mommy character in Nocturnal, because you've just got this termite queen that is actually a human woman, and it's really disgusting. Some of my best work, but that concept of,
if you want to talk about a gross scene, holy fuck.
Even the mommy at the end of Contagious was pretty, boils exploding in, clouds of infected dust, pust, and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And all that stuff plays off of existing survival strategies that are around us all the time, except for some of the body reshaping stuff. That's a little bit that you have to push to a huge degree to make that believable to people who have a rudimentary understanding of science.
Yeah. But I think one of the reasons that you get away with it is because you place this learning machine above the atmosphere, and you say, before anything happened, this thing was looking and studying humans for 20 years beforehand.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
we should move on to, yeah, the reason we got to, you know, it's lovely to discuss a movie
science
with a you know, published author, but we want to interview Scott in a little more details.
Yeah, I just thought we could do a Q&A with you. My first question would be, so from listening to your recent Q&A for The Gangster, you mentioned you have over 15 experts in your, you call it your Rolodex of awesome, to yep. consult their expertise for your writing. So a lot of authors, including myself, would just say, fuck it, and use creative license to explain the impossible. But why is it important to you to ground your works in realism and realistic science?
Well, there's two reasons for it. I guess three. Number one, I'm a science nerd. And in a lot of my story ideas come from reading, you know, scientific material or just watching things on like the Nature Channel. Like, holy crap, did that wasp just infect that caterpillar with like 18 larvae? It's just like that stuff just blows me away. I almost went into the sciences, wound up my ADD was just too much. And so I decided to create things instead. But the second reason is it's part of the magic spell I try and cast to get you to forget you're reading a book and just enjoy the experience. So it smells, looks, tastes, sounds real around you. And the way to do that is by giving you 10 to 20 things that you already know, that you guys would know down cold, but a lot of people don't know they know. So you introduce a little bit of science here, a little bit of science here, and people remember, they don't remember it, but subconsciously, like, they know it's true because they read about that in biology class in the 10th grade. They know these things are true, and that using the actual truth of things that exist in the real world around you creates this compact with the author where the reader starts to develop a huge amount of trust that this author is telling me things that are actually real and true, which lets you feel the story a little bit better. And more important, when I start to go from reality to plausibility to batshit crazy, I already own you to some extent. You're already there. So when it's in batshit crazy, you allow yourself to tune out the batshit. You just don't worry about it. You know, this plasticity of the human body is not even remotely possible, but you don't care anymore because you're all the way down the rabbit hole.
Essentially, you're the story wasp that's implanting yep. the eggs in your reader's brain.
Correct. Correct. And it's also the story wasp. I am doing things to your existing behavior that you want to be entertained. You want to read a story where you can go all the way in. It's just really hard to do that when you watch a movie or you read a book and they get something completely and utterly wrong. It's jarring and it takes you out of the story. You still enjoy it, but you're like, oh, it could have been so much better if they just knew that gravity works. You know, something along those yeah. lines. And the third reason is because I started out with podcasting. And I was trying to do this science-based horror. So like Stephen King using actual real-world science and physics. And I was fortunate enough that my first book, Earth Core, kind of took off a little bit in the podcasting space in 2005. And I started to get random emails from people who knew a whole lot about particular subjects. So I was screwing firearms. I'm not a gun guy. I know a lot more now, but I was getting things wrong. And, you know, service veterans and combat veterans were just very politely in like, hey, cool. Great story. Love it. But that's not how guns work. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to help. And then I started to get it from scientists. I started to get it from doctors. I started to get it from cops and firemen. And that's how the Rolodex of awesome kind of built itself cool. up, which was people very politely telling me that I didn't know what the fuck I was talking about. Your story could be so much better if you knew what the fuck you're talking about. I'm like, great. So, the thing I like to brag about is I consider myself to be the only peer-reviewed fiction author in the world. So that's where it comes
from. That's a really good way to put that.
Yeah. Cool. So have you ever written or had a plot direction that was straight vetoed by one of your consulting scientists or experts?
Or by using
like realistic science, it massively changed your story's path. So like, if that happened, how did you hurdle that?
Well, the first part of that question is all the time. The way I work now is if it is a modern day thriller, I do all the research I want to find the four or five scientific things I want to meld together. to make this crazy creature or monster situation, then I outline heavily. I got some outlines have been 72 pages long, single space, a really detailed outline. And then I give that over to my Rolodex of awesome people in their various fields of expertise. And then I just curl up into a fetal ball and wait for them to tell me why none of this works. And then we re-outline, and everybody and these people are so gracious with their time. And I know they enjoy it, but sometimes they're going through like three revisions of an outline and all playing off of each other to get it to a point where they can be like, okay, I would be able to read this and not be too taken out of the story. Yeah. So that happened. That's the normal process for one of my books. And then what I have to be careful of is nerding out over the science, you know, like let this particular thing in mitosis is so cool. Like I got to get this in the story. And then I will start to cram stuff into the story that doesn't belong there, that slows it down and bulks it up. So that's the other thing that the real science can get me into trouble, because I want to share all this cool stuff I have found with people, you know, at my level of scientific knowledge or below. The people above, you guys know tons of stuff, but trying to introduce these super cool scientific concepts to people that otherwise might not get them at all if they don't read my work. I want to do that, and it slows down the story. So I've had to learn to just strip it down to the bare minimum. And this is a cool thing. Now there's Google if you're interested. Go look it up.
Yeah. Sounds like you need your own version of a Cimmerillion for all your creatures and
we do. I've got a Siglerpedia. It's Siglerpedia, ScottSigler.com, where we try, and it's now been, you know, 20 years of this, so there's so much information. Yeah. And the fans will put it all up, and there's all the drawings of the different species and people trying to track everything together. And that'll really come into play. I think I'll finish up the Siglerverse where everything is connected. All the books are connected, and it's not a slapdash. Well, this tree was actually this guy, so therefore these stories are connected, that I've seen fans apply to some authors' work. Like there's a lot of meticulous thought to this timeline, how it all goes. But when it's all done, getting a big map so people can see all the Easter eggs, because I love Easter eggs like crazy, try and put them in there, see how it's all connected, will be this similar to the similar area.
So I know from personal world building experience that in-depth research can be exhausting, but for me, as trite as it is, Tolkien set the bar for me. And I want to emulate that level of detail for my readers, because it was such a wonderful experience for me as a reader myself. So my question to you is, did another author inspire you to go to such great research lengths, or was that just sort of your own science nerd passion?
It's a combination. My own scientific nerd passion drove me to consume authors that did what I do now, which is like, here's this cool scientific idea. Now we're going to make it crazy. Michael Crichton is a big one, obviously. Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child with their book, The Relic, that one absolutely blew me out of the water, because they were taking different scientific concepts and then strong arming them into a creature feature. And it was sensational. The movie Mimic was another big one. Cause they took a lot of actual real science and tried to apply it to the movie. And, I'm still waiting for the director's cut with all the scientific cut scenes that, you know, the stuff's in there. They just got rid of it for test audiences. But those were the things that just as a reader or a viewer gripped me and thrilled me. And I'm like, I want to do that right there. The Tolkien's a different thing to me. And I'm actually gravitating more toward that, projecting out 5 and 6 years of my career, where if I just make this shit up, you guys, the reader has no idea what's wrong, because everything's right because I made it up. And that because dude's like, yours. Here's dwarves, here's elves, because it's mine. Here's hobbits. Mm-hmm. Go and argue with me why their feet are big and they got furry toes. You can't, because I invented it. So there's a huge difference between, let me tell you a story that is set in the real world that is around you and try and make that real as possible, infected, contagious, and pandemic, and going over to the Galactic Football League, where, of course, these alien species are 100% correct because I invented them. And that is so much easier. It's so much easier and so much more fun. Writing a modern day thriller with real science in it is a giant pain in the ass.
I will say, though, as a reader of those books and also a scientist, reading about your Galactic Football League series of these aliens you've made up, they seem real. Like, it seems very feasible to me that these things could exist.
And that's the rudimentary scientific training I have, is just like, great, I understand the basis of evolution and how you go from a single cell to a sentient organism. So when I've kind of mapped out the evolution of all the five major races in there, and then try to use real world physiology, like this species has this thing going on, so therefore I know that works, so I can put that in the alien species.
I do like earlier that you were referring to yourself as the wasp that implants the story ideas into the caterpillar, because one of the things the caterpillar also does when the wasps start to hatch is the caterpillar will thrash to protect the wasp babies as they're emerging. And I've come to the conclusion that Adam is the caterpillar, because we're in a situation where with either Tolkien or with Sigler stuff, if we're like, hey, does that mechanism work? Adam's immediate response is, shut up, yes. Those hobbit feet are great. That idea makes sense. Ignore. Move on. And it's like, okay, that was very effective use of the caterpillar.
My next question is, so having seen an actual pandemic now in the real world, are there any aspects of your infected trilogy you would reconsider or add? And what do you feel like you got right?
The Trump connection's a complete and utter coincidence. Like, I started writing this book in, 2010, 2011. It was published in 2014. So the fact that an enormous amount of it takes place in the Trump Tower in Chicago, and that President Trump was a pivotal focal point in this spread of, not in the spread, but in when as COVID was happening, that's a total coincidence. I consider that very lucky as an author that that happened. But the thing I got right that is in there, and I don't think this took any prescience at all, anybody could see this coming, was disinformation and the spreading of disinformation online, and the distrust of science, the distrust of intelligent people, the automatic assumption that, well, the scientist says this is going on, so there's a financial advantage. This scientist wants to get rich off of this. All of that is in pandemic, and what I got absolutely right, and I wish I was wrong, was massive denial of science and people like, here is a cure, this will protect you. And millions of people going, blow it out your ass. I'm not taking that. That's a trick. And that is spread throughout pandemic. Yeah. I mean, I've even got, I've got Twitter fights in pandemic, which again came out in 2014, that read exactly like the Twitter fights you see when COVID was at its height and still going on. So that stuff is, that I got absolutely right. It's pretty darn depressing that I got it right. But that was something we could see coming with the polarization and the distrust of science.
Absolutely.
The only thing in that book I found unrealistic is the Republican president not knowing where the Americans got all the guns from.
That does seem a little silly. That character was fun too, because that was a hard right wing female president, very religious, very Christian, firm in her belief, which just, and that's something that, if you are left-leaning, center-leaning, non-denominational, etc., you're like, ooh, that gives you the willies. But that character was the right person at the right time to just go full bore into what became the cure. So that was also, that was a fun part of the book as well. It didn't work out in real life, but it worked out in the book.
Yeah, it's to your point about the disinformation, it's interesting. So in my own novel that I'm writing, it is also started this before COVID-19, and it has a pandemic-type story aspect. And so I did a lot of research into the Black Plague. And even back then, it was so much disinformation about, what caused it, what cured it from town to town. So you had people doing insane things because they thought it worked. You had people doing, nothing because they didn't care. So it's just history repeats itself, and it's pretty wild.
Yeah. It's staggering too. Like back then, there's very little knowledge of things. Like they don't understand how basically anything works.
Yeah.
And now we have all we have fourth, fifth generation scientists who know how things work in great detail, and we still get history still repeats itself.
Kind of almost makes it worse.
It makes it way worse. Way worse.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was going to say The Walking Dead definitely shifts if one of the characters gets bit and says, I'm going to be fine. Where's the ivermectin?
Yeah. Do you worm me? So James Gunn stated that he's fairly hardened to gore effects, but the dog corpse Starla finds in the basement actually made him sick.
Oh wow!
So I know when I was reading the Infected trilogy, the Jiffy Pop imagery really got me. Mm-hmm. So did any of your own descriptions ever get to you, and which one?
Well, obviously the end of Infected is a little bit disturbing. As a male of the species. But the physical gross out gore, I've been watching gory movies since I was a little kid, and I, you know, like that reaction, like, like that's why you go to those movies, be freaked out. I have personally a lot more trouble writing the scenes of people losing their mental acuity and Perry and Infected starting to become something that through no fault of his own, he has been parasitized and his behavior is being changed. So that's a theme I play with a lot, is the loss of control, the loss of cognition, the loss of self. If all those things could be melted together to describe as your essence or your soul, to have some biological reason that gets taken away from you is stuff that just, it's hard to write for me, because I've got, I've got a history of senility in the family, and I've watched this happen to people. And one of the things that affected my career the most is my maternal grandfather. He went senile and he was one of the most funny, brilliant, kind men I've ever known. And he just became this other person. And my dad was like, my dad said, well, that the computer's still there, but the software doesn't work anymore. And I was like, that little tagline has played into the really horrifying element of what I do, in my opinion, is taking away that sense of self and changing the soul and watching people become something else.
Yeah, that's a very horrifying thought.
Which happens to Grant in Slither. You know, like that's the best part. The best part of the whole movie overall is Rooker's performance, watching Grant struggle against this thing that is making him do all of this horrible crap, but he doesn't want to do it to that one person. And that's that's where, because Gunn wrote the screenplay and directed, and that's where the movie really excels, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his love for Starla trying to fight its way through. So my last question, final question for you is, what is your favorite movie monster of all time and why?
That's a very difficult one, because there's so many great movie monsters. You know, the Tremor monsters. I'm a huge fan of a 80s horror movie called Pumpkinhead, Demon of Revenge.
Yeah,
we did that on the podcast three, four weeks back.
Pumpkinhead episode.
Fantastic.
You can hear my impression of the witch.
Oh, fabulous. That's,
it's really good.
What did you think, Ed Harley, that it'd be all easy?
Ed Harley.
You're a fool, Ed Harley. You're a fool. I drive my wife insane by dropping Pumpkinhead references all the time to everything. The only movie I know dialogue more than Pumpkinhead is Aliens, which I think I stopped counting after I'd watched it 100 times. And because that is such a fascinating life cycle. In Alien, the life cycle's not like it didn't matter to explain the whole thing. But James Cameron coming in for Aliens and giving this very detailed life cycle that makes a lot of sense biologically. So that is the science nerd, the horror nerd, all of it coming together is the not just the xenomorph, but the whole life cycle as defined in Aliens is my favorite. And then as the movies progressed and they were just like, well, let's just throw this in here and stuff that makes no biological sense whatsoever or plot sense or story sense. Really has bummed me out, because that is my all-time favorite movie, favorite franchise. I think Aliens is the best movie that's ever been made. So that's what I go with.
Yeah. It's so hard to watch one of those just like shining pieces of work just deteriorate over time.
Yeah.
It's totally crazy. And having had some experience in Hollywood, having things adapted and things bought and then not made, is watching how the sausage gets made is just bonkers. You know, there is no peer review going on there. There are people under enormous pressure who suddenly get a great deal of power and are responsible for millions and millions of dollars, who are just like, oh, here's this director who's worked with this before. my job is safe. If that gets screwed up, that's not on me. And they just turn over all the power so they can go work on other things. Mm. And it's just watching, you know, random people get to come into positions of influence on franchises that are now 40 years old and have been watched billions of times. People getting to come in and just change that stuff is wild. And sometimes it works out great. Other times, not so much. Like the Fly remake, the Goldblum Fly remake, that's awesome. And that's very, yeah. very different than yeah. the original. But most of the time, it doesn't work out because there's so many. You don't just get to tell the story. You've got to meet budgets. You've got to meet timelines. There's a lot of pressures going into making movies. My wife, who's also my business partner, has a saying like, that movie was horrible and it's better than any movie I never made, which is yeah. the worst movie you've ever seen ever is a fucking miracle it got made at all. It's an incredibly complicated process. And even a very bad movie is a huge accomplishment. So, you know, what can you do? You're just trying to enjoy the gems while they're there.
You finished.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over. What the fuck are we going to do now?
Do we feel bad for the monsters in this movie, in Sliver?
What are we defining as the monsters? The original Parasite, Michael Rooker, or the townspeople?
Not the townspeople. The definitely not the townspeople. The thing that goes into Michael Rooker, the parasite itself. Do we feel bad for the parasite?
I do a
it
little
looks
bit.
Kind of helpless.
It's successful on an exponential scale that humanity can't even comprehend. This thing has been around for billions of years, you know? So it is a hugely successful organism with a strategy that has absolutely worked for it. And, you know, we're, what are we, chickens to it? You know, like you don't really care about chickens all that much. And there's millions of chickens and they're a food source. We put them in barns and raise them and slaughter them and eat them. So, the lone one, I think the character is called, the lone one is just landing in a giant chicken coop and then gets its ass whipped. So I actually do feel a bit bad for it because it finally got beat and it's never experienced that before. And then the other really lovely script writing that James Gunn did, which is Elizabeth Banks playing on like, you've been alone for so long. You don't have to be alone anymore. Yeah. And you're like, oh, you son of a bitch. Now I actually give a crap about this monster.
I feel bad. Everybody
knows what it's like to be lonely. Imagine being lonely for a billion years because you can't find anything, because you have to eat everything you find. So I do feel bad for the monster.
And this is another one of those parallels between this and the recent Suicide Squad movie, in that they just make you feel bad for the monster with one line, that whole, I was happy floating in the stars. That line really got me. That line got me in a way it didn't get me in this film. Because in this film, to continue with Scott's message, even, you know, when I wasn't a vegetarian, if a chicken had turned around and had a conversation with me in fluent English, or any human language, realistically, I like to think I would reconsider whether or not I eat it. So I do not feel bad for the monster in this movie. I definitely feel bad for the townspeople who get taken over. Well, most of them anyway.
Brenda especially.
Yeah. Definitely Brenda. I definitely feel bad for Brenda.
Brenda has a rough go of it. It would have been easier for Gunn to make her a more despicable character. You know, like she's out predating on all the married men in town. But she's just a lonely single mom who, you know, and it's that's what not making any of the townspeople transparently evil, except for maybe the mayor. He's kind of a dick. But it's a movie full of victims, man, and that's good work.
All right. Would we recommend this movie to people?
Absolutely.
Yes. Fuck yes.
Yeah.
I'd recommend it to my dad, not my mom. My mom.
Yeah. Not to anyone squeamish.
My mom won't read my books, so.
There'd have to be some sort of test. Like, do you get queasy at the sight of blood? Then don't watch this movie, like any of it.
Yeah.
Tentacles, anything like that. If you can deal with it, you'll be fine. But
gooey absorption.
Squelchy sounds.
I was surprised when I rewatched it for this podcast. I was genuinely surprised at how good of a movie it is from a structure and directorial and acting standpoint. A lot of the stuff I had not retained. I'm like, oh, that's a super fun creature feature. Michael Rooker's great. And we watched it this week and it was like, this is quite fantastic. So I would recommend this to anybody who loves monsters or sci-fi.
Yeah. I feel like it aged really well too. So
yes.
It's held up.
Part of what makes it age well too is, is, you know, like, look at the rock stars that have come out of this movie. And absolutely. Elizabeth Banks was a star, but not like she is now. Fillion, not like he is now. Rooker, you know, not Guardians of the Galaxy Rooker. Like this is a, now if you were to make this same movie again today, the budget, I'm going to guess, would be twice as much, if not three times as much, just to pay these people. So it's really cool
at least
that you had all of these people on the rise, but Gunn got them all in one place. And then, of course, Gunn's price tag himself. This would cost a lot of money to make just with the cast alone.
I was just kind of saying that I think similar to Scott of like seeing how the movie held up. I had not seen this movie until we did. We touched on this movie a little bit earlier in the year, Scott, when I defended my PhD thesis. We did like four Parasite movies and kind of talked about them briefly. And until then, I hadn't seen Slither. And I'd heard so many things about how good it was, how it's like this really good cult classic, James Gunn's from like start. And watching it, I'm like, this is one of the very few movies I can think of where having it being hyped up so much and I still enjoyed it. Like, I wasn't disappointed. I didn't feel let down. Hmm. Like, yeah, this absolutely deserves everything it's been getting.
Adam, what are we doing? What are we doing next week?
That's a great question. I don't know. Antlers.
I was going to say, isn't it Antlers?
Finally going to see Antlers after the pandemic has been slowing not only the ability to see movies down, but also the production and distribution of these movies. Mm-hmm. But yeah, next week is going to be Antlers, as we say at the end of every episode. First off, a little bit of a tidbit. Thank you, Scott, for joining us. Woo. And
yes, thank you.
Remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Universal Pictures.
Create a sick or something?
Comes a film so shocking. We got a real problem here. So disgusting.
Don't let him in your mouth!
It will change the face of horror.
Marriage is a sacred bond, for better or worse.
Much worse.